himself, were set in their ways right from the start. People couldn't become truly holy, he said, unless they also had the opportunity to be definitively wicked. Crowley had thought about this for some time, and around 1023 had said, "Hang on, that only works, right, if you start everyone off equal, okay? You can't start someone off in a muddy shack in the middle of a war zone and expect them to do as well as someone born in a castle." Ah, Aziraphale had said, "That's the good bit. The lower you start, the more opportunities you have." Crowley had said, "Oh, that's lunatic." "No," said Aziraphale, "it's ineffable." Aziraphale. The enemy, of course, but an enemy for 6,000 years now, which made him a sort of friend. Crowley reached down and picked up the car phone. Being a demon, of course, was supposed to mean you had no free will. But you couldn't hang around humans for very long without learning a thing or two. Mr. Young had not been too keen on Damien, or Wormwood, or any of Sister Mary Loquacious's other suggestions, which had covered half of Hell and most of the golden years of Hollywood. "Well," she said finally, a little hurt, "I don't think there's anything wrong with Errol or Kerry. Very nice American names, both of them."
"I'd fancied something more, well, traditional," explained Mr. Young. "We've always gone in for good, simple names in our family."
Sister Mary beamed. "That's right. The old names are always the best, if you ask me."
"A decent English name, like people had in the Bible," said Mr. Young. "Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John," he said, speculatively. Sister Mary winced. "Only they've never struck me as very good Bible names, really," Mr. Young added. "They sound more like cowboys and footballers."
"Saul's nice," said Sister Mary, making the best of it.
"I don't want something too old-fashioned," said Mr. Young.
"Or Cain. Very modern sound, Cain, really," Sister Mary tried.
Mr. Young looked doubtful.
"Or there's always... well, there's always Adam," said Sister Mary. "That should be safe enough," she thought.
"Adam," said Mr. Young. It would be nice to think that the Satanist nuns had the surplus baby, Baby B, discreetly adopted, that he grew to be a normal, happy, laughing child, active and exuberant, and after that grew further to become a normal, fairly contented adult. And perhaps that's what happened. Let your mind dwell on his junior school prize for spelling, his unremarkable, although quite pleasant time at university, his job in the payroll department of the Tadfield and Norton Building Society, his lovely wife. Possibly you would like to imagine some children, and a hobby, restoring vintage motorcycles, perhaps, or breeding tropical fish. You don't want to know what could have happened to Baby B. We like your version better, anyway. He probably wins prizes for his tropical fish. In a small house in Dorking, Surrey, a light was on in a bedroom window. Newton Pulsifer was 12 and thin and bespectacled, and he should have been in bed hours ago. His mother, though, was convinced of her child's genius and let him stay up past his bedtime to do his experiments. His current experiment was changing a plug on an ancient Bakelite radio his mother had given him to play with. He sat at what he proudly called his worktop, a battered old table covered in curls of wire, batteries, little light bulbs, and a homemade crystal set that had never worked. He hadn't managed to get the Bakelite radio working yet either. But then again, he never seemed able to get that far. 3 slightly crooked model airplanes hung on cotton cords from his bedroom ceiling. Even a casual observer could have seen that they were made by someone who was both painstaking and very careful, and also no good at making model airplanes. He was hopelessly proud of all of them, even the Spitfire, where he'd made rather a mess of the wings. He pushed his glasses back up the bridge of his nose, squinted down at the plug, and put down the screwdriver. He had high hopes for it this time. He had followed all the instructions on plug changing on page 5 of the Boy's Own Book of Practical Electronics, including 101 safe and educational things to do with electricity. He'd attached the correct color-coded wires to the correct pins. He'd checked that it was the right amperage fuse. He'd screwed it all back together. So far, no problems. He plugged it into the socket. Then he switched the socket on. Every light in the house went out. Newton beamed with pride. He was getting better. Last time he'd done it, he'd blacked out the whole of Dorking. And a man from the electric had come over and had a word with his mum. He had a burning and totally unrequited passion for things electrical. They had a computer at school, and half a dozen studious children stayed on after school doing things with punched cards. When the teacher in charge of the computer had finally acceded to Newton's pleas to be allowed to join them, Newton had only ever got to feed one little card into the machine. It had chewed it up and choked fatally on it. Newton was certain that the future was in computers, and when the future arrived, he'd be ready in the forefront of the new technology. The future had its own ideas on this. It was all in the book. Adam, thought Mr. Young. He tried saying it to see how it sounded. Adam. He stared down at the golden curls of the adversary, destroyer of kings, angel of the bottomless pit, great beast that is called dragon, prince of this world, father of lies, spawn of Satan, and lord of darkness. You know, he concluded, after a while, I think he actually looks like an Adam. It had not been a dark and stormy night. The dark and stormy night occurred 2 days later, about 4 hours after both Mrs. Dowling and Mrs. Young and their respective babies had left the building. It was a particularly dark and stormy night, and just after midnight, as the storm reached its height, a bolt of lightning struck the convent of the Chattering Order, setting fire to the roof of the vestry. No one was badly hurt by the fire, but it went on for some hours, doing a fair amount of damage in the process. The instigator of the fire lurked on a nearby hilltop and watched the blaze. He was tall, thin, and a duke of hell. It was the last thing that needed to be done before his return to the nether regions, and he had done it. He could safely leave the rest to Crowley. Haster went home. Technically, Aziraphale was a principality, but people made jokes about that these days. On the whole, neither he nor Crowley would have chosen each other's company, but they were both men, or at least men-shaped creatures, of the world, and the arrangement had worked to their advantage all this time. Besides, you grew accustomed to the only other face that had been around, more or less consistently, for 6 millennia. The arrangement was very simple. So simple, in fact, that it didn't really deserve the capital letter, which it had got for simply being in existence for so long. It was the sort of sensible arrangement that many isolated agents, working in awkward conditions a long way from their superiors, reach with their opposite number, when they realize that they have more in common with their immediate opponents than their remote allies. It meant a tacit non-interference in certain of each other's activities. It made certain that while neither really won, also neither really lost, and both were able to demonstrate to their masters the great strides they were making against a cunning and well-informed adversary. It meant that Crowley had been allowed to develop Manchester, while Aziraphale had a free hand in the whole of Shropshire. Crowley took Glasgow, Aziraphale had Edinburgh, neither claimed any responsibility for Milton Keynes, but both reported it as a success. Footnote. Note for Americans and other aliens, Milton Keynes is a new city, approximately halfway between London and Birmingham. It was built to be modern, efficient, healthy, and all in all, a pleasant place to live. Many Britons find this amusing. And then, of course, it had seemed even natural that they should, as it were, hold the fort for one another whenever common sense dictated. Both were of angel stock, after all. If one was going to Hull for a quick temptation, it made sense to nip across the city and carry out a standard brief moment of divine ecstasy. It'd get done anyway, and being sensible about it gave everyone more free time and cut down on expenses. Aziraphale felt the occasional pang of guilt about this, but centuries of association with humanity was having the same effect on him as it was on Crowley, except in the other direction. Besides, the authorities didn't seem to care much who did anything, so long as it got done. Currently, what Aziraphale was doing was standing, with Crowley, by the duck pond in St. James's Park. They were feeding the ducks. The ducks in St. James's Park are so used to being fed bread by secret agents meeting clandestinely that they have developed their own Pavlovian reaction. Put a St. James's Park duck in a laboratory cage and show it a picture of two men, one usually wearing a coat with a fur collar, the other something somber with a scarf, and it'll look up expectantly. The Russian cultural attaché's black bread is particularly sought after by the more discerning duck, while the head of MI9's soggy Hovis with Marmite is relished by the connoisseurs. Aziraphale tossed a crust to a scruffy-looking drake, which caught it and sank immediately. The angel turned to Crowley. "Really, my dear," he murmured. "Sorry," said Crowley, "I was forgetting myself." The duck bobbed angrily to the surface. "Of course we knew something was going on," Aziraphale said. "But one somehow imagines this sort of thing happening in America. They go in for that sort of thing over there." "It might yet do, at that," said Crowley gloomily. He gazed thoughtfully across the park to the Bentley, the back wheel of which was being industriously clamped. "Oh, yes, the American diplomat," said the angel. "Rather showy, one feels. As if Armageddon was some sort of cinematographic show that you wish to sell in as many countries as possible."
"Every country," said Crowley. "The earth and all the kingdoms thereof."
Aziraphale tossed the last scrap of bread at the ducks, who went off to pester the Bulgarian naval attaché and a furtive-looking man in a Cambridge tie, and carefully disposed of the paper bag in a waste paper bin. He turned and faced Crowley.
"We'll win, of course," he said.
"You don't want that," said the demon.
"Why not, pray?"
"Listen," said Crowley desperately. "How many musicians do you think your side have got, eh? First grade, I mean." Aziraphale looked taken aback.
"Well, I should think," he began.
"Two," said Crowley. "Elgar and Liszt. That's all. We've got the rest. Beethoven, Brahms, all the Bachs. Mozart, the lot. Can you imagine eternity with Elgar?"
Aziraphale shut his eyes. "All too easily," he groaned.
"Ah, that's it then," said Crowley, with a gleam of triumph. He knew Aziraphale's weak spot, all right. "No more compact discs, no more Albert Hall, no more proms, no more Glyndebourne, just celestial harmonies all day long."
"Ineffable," Aziraphale murmured.
"Like eggs without salt," you said. "Which reminds me, no salt, no eggs. No Gravlax with dill sauce. No fascinating little restaurants where they know you. No Daily Telegraph crossword. No small antique shops. No bookshops, either. No interesting old editions. No..." Crowley scraped the bottom of Aziraphale's barrel of interests. "Regency silver snuff boxes."
"But after we win, life will be better," croaked the angel.
"But it won't be as interesting." "Look, you know I'm right. You'd be as happy with a harp as I'd be with a pitchfork."
"You know we don't play harps, and we don't use pitchforks. I was being rhetorical."
They stared at one another. Aziraphale spread his elegantly manicured hands.
"My people are more than happy for it to happen, you know. It's what it's all about, you see, the great final test, flaming swords, the four horsemen, seas of blood, the whole tedious business."
He shrugged. "And then game over, insert coin," said Crowley.
"Sometimes I find your methods of expression a little difficult to follow."
"I like the seas as they are. It doesn't have to happen. You don't have to test everything to destruction just to see if you made it right." Aziraphale shrugged again.
"Well, that's ineffable wisdom for you, I'm afraid."
The angel shuddered and pulled his coat around him. Grey clouds were piling up over the city.
Oh, let's go somewhere warm, he said.
You're asking me? Said Crowley, glumly. They walked in somber silence for a while.
It's not that I disagree with you, said the angel, as they plodded across the grass. It's just that I'm not allowed to disobey. You know that.
Me too, said Crowley.
Aziraphale gave him a sidelong glance.
Oh, come now, he said. You're a demon, after all.
Yeah, but my people are only in favour of disobedience in general terms. It's specific disobedience they come down on heavily.
Such as disobedience to themselves?
You got it. You'd be amazed. Or perhaps you wouldn't be.
How long do you think we've got?
Crowley waved a hand at the Bentley, which unlocked its doors.
The prophecies differ, said Aziraphale, sliding into the passenger seat. Certainly until the end of the century, although we may expect certain phenomena before then. Most of the prophets of the past millennium were more concerned with scansion than accuracy.
Crowley pointed to the ignition key. It turned.
What? He said.
You know, said the angel, helpfully, and the worldy unto an endy shall come in tumpty-tumpty-tumpty-one, or two, or three, or whatever. There aren't many good rhymes for six, so it's probably a good year to be in.
And what sort of phenomena?
Two-headed calves, signs in the sky, geese flying backwards, showers of fish, that sort of thing.
The presence of the Antichrist affects the natural operation of causality.
Hmm. Crowley put the Bentley in gear. Then he remembered something. He snapped his fingers. The wheel clamps disappeared.
Let's have lunch, he said. I owe you one from, when was it?
Paris, 1793, said Aziraphale.
Oh, yeah, the Reign of Terror.
Was that one of yours or one of ours?
Wasn't it yours? I can't recall. It was quite a good restaurant, though.
As they drove past an astonished traffic warden, his notebook spontaneously combusted, to Crowley's amazement.
Well, I'm pretty certain I didn't mean to do that, he said.
Aziraphale blushed.
That was me, he said.
I'd always thought that your people invented them.
Oh, did you? Well, we thought they were yours.
Crowley stared at the smoke in the rear-view mirror.
Come on, he said. Let's do the Ritz.
Crowley had not bothered to book. In his world, table reservations were things that happened to other people. Aziraphale collected books.
If he were totally honest with himself, he would have to have admitted that his bookshop was simply somewhere to store them.
He was not unusual in this. In order to maintain his cover, as a typical second-hand bookseller, he used every means, short of actual physical violence, to prevent customers from making a purchase. Unpleasant damp smells, glowering looks, erratic opening hours, he was incredibly good at it. He had been collecting for a long time, and like all collectors, he specialized. He had more than 60 books of predictions concerning developments in the last handful of centuries of the second millennium. He had a penchant for wild first editions, and he had a complete set of the infamous Bibles, individually named from errors in typesetting. These Bibles included the Unrighteous Bible, so called from a printer's error which caused it to proclaim, in 1 Corinthians, "Know ye not that the unrighteous shall inherit the kingdom of God?" And the Wicked Bible, printed by Barker and Lucas in 1632, in which the word "not" was omitted from the seventh commandment, making it, "Thou shalt commit adultery." There were the Discharge Bible, the Treacle Bible, the Standing Fishes Bible, the Charing Cross Bible, and the rest. Aziraphale had them all. Even the very rarest, a Bible published in 1651 by the London publishing firm of Bilton and Skaggs. It had been the first of their three great publishing disasters. The book was commonly known as the Bugger All This Bible. The lengthy compositor's error, if such it may be called, occurs in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 48, verse 5. "Two, and by the border of Dan, from the east side to the west side, a portion of Asher. Three,
and by the border of Asher, from the east side even unto the west side, a portion for Naphtali. 4. And by the border of Naphtali, from the east side unto the west side, a portion for Manasseh. 5. Bugger all this for a lark. I am sick to my heart of typesetting ye. Master Bilton is no gentleman, and Master Skaggs no more than a tight-fisted Southwark knobsticker. I tell you, on a day like this, any one with half an ounce of sense should be out in the sunshine, and not stuck here all o' the livelong day in this mouldy old by our lady workshoppy. At asterisk quotation A, at exclamation mark semicolon, exclamation mark asterisk. 6. And by the border of Ephraim, from the east side even unto the west side, a portion for Reuben. Footnote. The Bugger All This Bible was also noteworthy for having 27 verses in the third chapter of Genesis instead of the more usual 24. They followed verse 24, which in the King James Version reads, "So he drove out the man, and he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubims, and a flaming sword which turned every way to keep the way of the tree of life," and read, verse 25, "And the Lord spake unto the angel that guarded the eastern gate, saying, Where is the flaming sword which was given unto thee?" Verse 26, "And the angel said, I had it here only a moment ago, I must have put it down somewhere. Forget my own head next." Verse 27, "And the Lord did not ask him again." It appears that these verses were inserted during the proof stage. In those days it was common practice for printers to hang proof sheets to the wooden beams outside their shops for the edification of the populace and some free proofreading. And since the whole print run was subsequently burned anyway, no one bothered to take up this matter with the nice Mr. A. Zirafale, who ran the bookshop two doors along and was always so helpful with the translations, and whose handwriting was instantly recognisable. Bilton and Skaggs's second great publishing disaster occurred in 1653. By a stroke of rare good fortune, they had obtained one of the famed Lost Quartos, the three Shakespeare plays never reissued in folio edition, and now totally lost to scholars and playgoers. Only their names have come down to us. This one was Shakespeare's earliest play, The Comedy of Robin Hood, or The Forest of Sherwood. Footnote. The other two are The Trapping of the Mouse and Gold Diggers of 1589. Master Bilton had paid almost 6 guineas for the quarto and believed that he could make nearly twice that much back on the hardcover folio alone. Then he lost it. Bilton and Skaggs's third great publishing disaster was never entirely comprehensible to either of them. Everywhere you looked, books of prophecy were selling like crazy. The English edition of Nostradamus's Centuries had just gone into its third printing, and 5 Nostradamuses, all claiming to be the only genuine one, were on triumphant signing tours. And Mother Shipton's collection of prophecies was sprinting out of the shops. Each of the great London publishers, there were 8 of them, had at least 1 book of prophecy on its list. Every single one of the books was wildly inaccurate, but their air of vague and generalized omnipotence made them immensely popular. They sold in the thousands and in the tens of thousands. "It is a license to print money," said Master Bilton to Master Skaggs. Footnote. Who had already had a few thoughts in that direction, and spent the last years of his life in Newgate Prison, when he eventually put them into practice. "The public are crying out for such rubbish. We must straightway print a book of prophecy by some hag." The manuscript arrived at their door the next morning. The author's sense of timing, as always, was exact. Although neither Master Bilton nor Master Skaggs realized it, the manuscript they had been sent was the sole prophetic work in all of human history to consist entirely of completely correct predictions concerning the following 340-odd years, being a precise and accurate description of the events that would culminate in Armageddon. It was on the money in every single detail. It was published by Bilton and Skaggs in September 1655, in good time for the Christmas trade. Footnote. Another masterstroke of publishing genius, because Oliver Cromwell's Puritan Parliament had made Christmas illegal in 1654. And it was the first book printed in England to be remaindered. It didn't sell. Not even the copy in the tiny Lancashire shop with local author on a piece of cardboard next to it. The author of the book, one Agnes Nutter, was not surprised by this, but then it would have taken an awful lot to surprise Agnes Nutter. Anyway, she had not written it for the sales or the royalties, or even for the fame. She had written it for the single gratis copy of the book that an author was entitled to. No one knows what happened to the legions of unsold copies of her book. Certainly none remain in any museums or private collections. Even Aziraphale does not possess a copy, but would go weak at the knees at the thought of actually getting his exquisitely manicured hands on one. In fact, only one copy of Agnes Nutter's prophecies remained in the entire world. It was on a bookshelf about 40 miles away from where Crowley and Aziraphale were enjoying a rather good lunch, and, metaphorically, it had just begun to tick. And now, it was 3 o'clock. The Antichrist had been on Earth for 15 hours, and one angel and one demon had been drinking solidly for 3 of them. They sat opposite one another in the back room of Aziraphale's dingy old bookshop in Soho. Most bookshops in Soho have back rooms, and most of the back rooms are filled with rare, or at least very expensive, books. But Aziraphale's books didn't have illustrations. They had old brown covers and crackling pages. Occasionally, if he had no alternative, he'd sell one. And occasionally, serious men in dark suits would come calling and suggest, very politely, that perhaps he'd like to sell the shop itself so that it could be turned into the kind of retail outlet more suited to the area. Sometimes they'd offer cash in large rolls of grubby £50 notes. Or sometimes, while they were talking, other men in dark glasses would wander around the shop shaking their heads and saying how inflammable paper was, and what a fire trap he had here. And Aziraphale would nod and smile, and say that he'd think about it. And then they'd go away. And they'd never come back. Just because you're an angel doesn't mean you have to be a fool. The table in front of the two of them was covered with bottles.
"The point is," said Crowley, "the point is... the point is..."
He tried to focus on Aziraphale.
"The point is,"
he said, and tried to think of a point.
"The point I'm trying to make," he said, brightening, "is the dolphins. That's my point."
"Kind of fish?" said Aziraphale.
"No, no, no," said Crowley, shaking a finger. "It's mammal. Your actual mammal. Difference is..."
Crowley waded through the swamp of his mind and tried to remember the difference.
"The difference is they mate out of water,"
volunteered Aziraphale. Crowley's brow furrowed.
"Don't think so. I'm pretty sure that's not it. Something about their young... whatever."
He pulled himself together.
The point is their brains."
He reached for a bottle.
"What about their brains?" said the angel. "Big brains, that's my point. Size of damn big brains. And then there's the whales. Brain city, take it from me. Whole damn sea full of brains."
"Kraken," said Aziraphale, staring moodily into his glass. Crowley gave him the long, cool look of someone who has just had a girder dropped in front of his train of thought.
"Huh? Great big bugger,"
said Aziraphale, sleepeth beneath the thunders of the upper deep, under loads of huge and unnumbered bloody great seaweeds, you know, supposed to rise to the surface right at the end, when the sea boils.
Yeah? Fact.
Well, there you are, then, said Crowley, sitting back. Whole sea, bubbling, poor old dolphins, so much seafood, gumbo, no one giving a damn. Same with gorillas. Whoops, they say, sky gone all red, stars crashing to ground. What are they putting in the bananas these days? And then they make nests, you know, gorillas, said the angel, pouring another drink, and managing to hit the glass on the third go.
Nah, God's truth. And saw a film. Nests.
Oh, that's birds, said Crowley.
Nests, insisted Aziraphale.
Crowley decided not to argue the point.
Well, there you are, then, he said. All creatures, great and smoke. Small. Great and small. A lot of them with brains. And then, bazam.
But you're part of it, said Aziraphale. You tempt people. You're good at it.
Crowley thumped his glass on the table.
Oh, that's different. They don't have to say yes. That's the ineffable bit, right? Your side made it up. You've got to keep testing people.
But not to destruction.
All right. All right. I don't like it any more than you do. But I told you I can't not do what I'm told. I'm an angel.
There's no theatres in heaven, said Crowley, and very few films.
Don't you try to tempt me, said Aziraphale, wretchedly. I know you, you old serpent.
Just you think about it, said Crowley, relentlessly. You know what eternity is? You know what eternity is? I mean, do you know what eternity is? There's this big mountain, you see? A mile high, at the end of the universe. And once every 1,000 years, there's this little bird.
What little bird?
Said Aziraphale suspiciously.
This little bird I'm talking about. And every 1,000 years, the same bird, every 1,000 years?
Crowley hesitated.
Yeah, he said. Bloody ancient bird, then.
Okay. And every 1,000 years... this bird flies,
limps,
flies all the way to this mountain and sharpens its beak. Hold on. You can't do that. Between here and the end of the universe, there's loads...
The angel waved a hand expansively, if a little unsteadily.
Loads of bugger all, dear boy.
But it goes there anyway, Crowley persevered.
How?
Well, it doesn't matter.
It could use a spaceship, said the angel.
Crowley subsided a bit.
Yeah, he said, if you like. Anyway, this bird...
Only it is the end of the universe we're talking about, said Aziraphale. So it'd have to be one of those spaceships where your descendants are the ones who get out at the other end. You have to tell your descendants. You say, when you get to the mountain... You've got to...
He hesitated.
What have they got to do?
Sharpen its beak on the mountain, said Crowley. And then it flies back.
In the spaceship.
And after 1,000 years it goes and does it all again, said Crowley quickly.
There was a moment of drunken silence.
Seems a lot of effort just to sharpen a beak, mused Aziraphale.
Listen, said Crowley, urgently. The point is that when the bird has worn the mountain down to nothing...
Right.
Then Aziraphale opened his mouth. Crowley just knew he was going to make some point about the relative hardness of birds' beaks and granite mountains, and plunged on quickly.
Then you still won't have finished watching The Sound of Music.
Aziraphale froze.
And you'll enjoy it. Crowley said relentlessly. You really will.
My dear boy, you won't have a choice.
Listen, heaven has no taste.
Now...
And not one single sushi restaurant.
A look of pain crossed the angel's suddenly very serious face.
I can't cope with this while I'm drunk,
he said.
I'm going to sober up.
Me too.
They both winced as the alcohol left their bloodstreams and sat up a bit more neatly. Aziraphale straightened his tie.
I can't interfere with divine plans, he croaked.
Crowley looked speculatively into his glass and then filled it again.
What about diabolical ones? He said.
Pardon?
Well, it's got to be a diabolical plan, hasn't it? We're doing it, my side.
Ah, but it's all part of the overall divine plan, said Aziraphale.
Your side can't do anything without it being part of the ineffable divine plan, he added, with a trace of smugness.
You wish.
No, that's the... Aziraphale snapped his fingers irritably. The thing, what do you call it in your colourful idiom? The line at the bottom.
The bottom line?
Yes, it's that.
Well, if you're sure, said Crowley.
No doubt about it.
Crowley looked up slyly. Then you can't be certain, correct me if I'm wrong, you can't be certain that thwarting it isn't part of the divine plan too. I mean, you're supposed to thwart the wiles of the evil one at every turn, aren't you?
Aziraphale hesitated.
There is that, yes.
You see a wile, you thwart. Am I right?
Broadly. Actually, I encourage humans to do the actual thwarting. Because of ineffability, you understand?
Right. So all you've got to do is thwart. Because if I know anything, said Crowley urgently, it's that the birth is just the start. It's the upbringing that's important. It's the influences. Otherwise the child will never learn to use its powers.
He hesitated. At least, not necessarily as intended.
And certainly our side won't mind me thwarting you, said Aziraphale thoughtfully.
They won't mind that at all.
Right. It'll be a real feather in your wing.
Crowley gave the angel an encouraging smile.
What will happen to the child if it doesn't get a satanic upbringing, though? Said Aziraphale.
Probably nothing. It'll never know.
But genetics...
Don't tell me from genetics. What have they got to do with it? Said Crowley.
Look at Satan, created as an angel, grows up to be the great adversary. Hey, if you're going to go on about genetics, you might as well say the kid will grow up to be an angel.
After all, his father was really big in heaven in the old days. Saying he'll grow up to be a demon just because his dad became one is like saying a mouse with its tail cut off will give birth to tailless mice.
No. Upbringing is everything. Take it from me.
And without unopposed satanic influences?
Well, at worst, hell will have to start all over again. And the Earth gets at least another 11 years. That's got to be worth something, hasn't it?
Now Aziraphale was looking thoughtful again.
You're saying the child isn't evil of itself, he said slowly.
Well, potentially evil.
Potentially good, too, I suppose. Just this huge, powerful potentiality waiting to be shaped, said Crowley.
He shrugged.
Anyway, why are we talking about this good and evil? They're just names for sides. We know that.
I suppose it's got to be worth a try, said the angel.
Crowley nodded encouragingly.
Agreed,
said the demon, holding out his hand. The angel shook it cautiously.
It'll certainly be more interesting than saints, he said.
And it'll be for the child's own good in the long run, said Crowley.
We'll be godfathers, sort of. Overseeing his religious upbringing, you might say.
Aziraphale beamed.
You know, I'd never have thought of that, he said. Godfathers? Well, I'll be damned.
It's not too bad, said Crowley. When you get used to it.
She was known as Scarlet. At that time, she was selling arms, although it was beginning to lose its savour.
She never stuck at one job for very long. 300-400 years at the outside. You didn't want to get in a rut.
Her hair was true auburn, neither ginger nor brown, but a deep and burnished copper colour. And it fell to her waist in tresses that men would kill for, and indeed often had.
Her eyes were a startling orange. She looked 25, and always had. She had a dusty brick-red truck full of assorted weaponry and an almost unbelievable skill at getting it across any border in the world. She'd been on her way to a small West African country, where a minor civil war was in progress, to make a delivery which would, with any luck, turn it into a major civil war. Unfortunately, the truck had broken down, far beyond even her ability to repair it, and she was very good with machinery these days. She was in the middle of a city at the time. Footnote. Nominally a city. It was the size of an English county town, or, translated into American terms, a shopping mall. The city in question was the capital of Kambolaland, an African nation which had been at peace for the last 3,000 years. For about 30 years, it was Sir Humphrey Clarkson land, but since the country had absolutely no mineral wealth and the strategic importance of a banana, it was accelerated towards self-government with almost unseemly haste. Kambolaland was poor, perhaps, and undoubtedly boring, but peaceful. Its various tribes, who got along with one another quite happily, had long since beaten their swords into ploughshares. A fight had broken out in the city square in 1952 between a drunken ox drover and an equally drunken ox thief. People were still talking about it. Scarlet yawned in the heat. She fanned her head with her broad-brimmed hat, left the useless truck in the dusty street, and wandered into a bar. She bought a can of beer, drained it, then grinned at the barman. "I got a truck. Needs repairing," she said. "Anyone around I can talk to?" The barman grinned white and huge and expansively. He'd been impressed by the way she drank her beer. "Only Nathan, miss. But Nathan has gone back to Kaunda to see his father-in-law's farm." Scarlet bought another beer. "So, this Nathan, any idea when he'll be back?"
"Perhaps next week, perhaps 2 weeks' time, dear lady." "Oh, that Nathan, he is a scamp, no?" He leaned forward. "You travelling alone, miss?" he said.
"Yes."
"Could be dangerous. Some funny people on the roads these days. Bad men. Not local boys," he added quickly.
Scarlet raised a perfect eyebrow. Despite the heat, he shivered.
"Thanks for the warning," Scarlet purred.
Her voice sounded like something that lurks in the long grass, visible only by the twitching of its ears, until something young and tender wobbles by. She tipped her hat to him and strolled outside. The hot African sun beat down on her. Her truck sat in the street with a cargo of guns and ammunition and landmines. It wasn't going anywhere. Scarlet stared at the truck. A vulture was sitting on its roof. It had travelled 300 miles with Scarlet so far. It was belching quietly. She looked around the street. A couple of women chatted on a street corner. A bored market vendor sat in front of a heap of coloured goods, fanning the flies. A few children played lazily in the dust.
"What the hell?" she said, quietly. "I could do with a holiday anyway."
That was Wednesday. By Friday, the city was a no-go area. By the following Tuesday, the economy of Kambolaland was shattered. 20,000 people were dead, including the barman, shot by the rebels while storming the market barricades. Almost 100,000 people were injured. All of Scarlet's assorted weapons had fulfilled the function for which they had been created, and the vulture had died of greasy degeneration. Scarlet was already on the last train out of the country. It was time to move on, she felt. She'd been doing arms for too damn long. She wanted a change. Something with openings. She quite fancied herself as a newspaper journalist. A possibility. She fanned herself with her hat and crossed her long legs in front of her. Farther down the train, a fight broke out. Scarlet grinned.
People were always fighting over her and around her. It was rather sweet, really. Sable had black hair, a trim black beard, and he had just decided to go corporate. He did drinks with his accountant.
"How are we doing, Franny?" he asked her.
12 million copies sold so far. Can you believe that?
They were doing drinks in a restaurant called Top of the Sixes, on the top of 666 Fifth Avenue, New York. This was something that amused Sable ever so slightly. From the restaurant windows, you could see the whole of New York. At night, the rest of New York could see the huge red 666s that adorned all four sides of the building. Of course, it was just another street number. If you started counting, you'd be bound to get to it eventually. But you had to smile. Sable and his accountant had just come from a small, expensive, and particularly exclusive restaurant in Greenwich Village, where the cuisine was entirely nouvelle. A string bean, a pea, and a sliver of chicken breast aesthetically arranged on a square china plate. Sable had invented it the last time he'd been in Paris. His accountant had polished her meat and two veg off in under 50 seconds and had spent the rest of the meal staring at the plate, the cutlery, and from time to time at her fellow diners in a manner that suggested that she was wondering what they'd taste like, which was in fact the case. It had amused Sable enormously. He toyed with his Perrier.
12 million, huh? That's pretty good.
That's great.
So we're going corporate. It's time to blow the big one, am I right? California, I think. I want factories, restaurants, the whole schmear. We'll keep the publishing arm, but it's time to diversify. Yeah?
Franny nodded. Sounds good, Sable. We'll need... She was interrupted by a skeleton. A skeleton in a Dior dress, with tanned skin stretched almost to snapping point over the delicate bones of the skull. The skeleton had long blonde hair and perfectly made-up lips. She looked like the person mothers around the world would point to, muttering, "That's what'll happen to you if you don't eat your greens." She looked like a famine relief poster with style. She was New York's top fashion model, and she was holding a book. She said, "Oh, excuse me, Mr. Sable, I hope you don't mind me intruding, but your book, it changed my life. I was wondering... would you mind signing it for me?" She stared imploringly at him with eyes deep sunk in gloriously eye-shadowed sockets. Sable nodded graciously and took the book from her. It was not surprising that she had recognized him, for his dark grey eyes stared out from his photo on the foil-embossed cover. "Foodless Dieting, Slim Yourself Beautiful," the book was called, "The Diet Book of the Century."
"How do you spell your name?" he asked.
"Cheryl. 2 R's, 1 Y, 1 L.
"You remind me of an old, old friend," he told her, as he wrote swiftly and carefully on the title page. "There you go. Glad you liked it. Always good to meet a fan."
What he'd written was this.
"Cheryl. A measure of wheat for a penny, and 3 measures of barley for a penny, and see thou hurt not the oil and the wine. Revelations 6:6. Dr. Raven Sable."
"It's from the Bible," he told her. She closed the book reverently and backed away from the table, thanking Sable. He didn't know how much this meant to her. He had changed her life. Truly he had.
He had never actually earned the medical degree he claimed, since there hadn't been any universities in those days. But Sable could see she was starving to death. He gave her a couple of months at the outside. "Foodless. Handle your weight problem terminally."
Franny was stabbing at her laptop computer hungrily, planning the next phase in Sable's transformation of the eating habits of the Western world. Sable had bought her the machine as a personal present. It was very, very expensive, very powerful, and ultra-slim. He liked slim things. "There's a European outfit we can buy into for the initial toehold, Holdings Incorporated.
That'll give us the Liechtenstein tax base. Now, if we channel funds out through the Caymans, into Luxembourg, and from there to Switzerland, we could pay for the factories in... But Sable was no longer listening. He was remembering the exclusive little restaurant. It had occurred to him that he had never seen so many rich people so hungry. Sable grinned, the honest, open grin that goes with job satisfaction, perfect and pure. He was just killing time until the main event, but he was killing it in such exquisite ways. Time. And sometimes people. Sometimes he was called White, or Blanc, or Albus, or Chalky, or Weiss, or Snowy, or any one of 100 other names. His skin was pale, his hair a faded blonde, his eyes light grey. He was somewhere in his 20s at a casual glance, and a casual glance was all anyone ever gave him. He was almost entirely unmemorable. Unlike his two colleagues, he could never settle down in any one job for very long. He had had all manner of interesting jobs in lots of interesting places. He had worked at the Chernobyl power station, and at Windscale, and at Three Mile Island, always in minor jobs that weren't very important. He had been a minor but valued member of a number of scientific research establishments. He had helped to design the petrol engine, and plastics, and the ring pull can. He could turn his hand to anything. Nobody really noticed him. He was unobtrusive. His presence was cumulative. If you thought about it carefully, you could figure out he had to have been doing something, had to have been somewhere. Maybe he even spoke to you. But he was easy to forget, was Mr. White. At this time, he was working as a deckhand on an oil tanker heading toward Tokyo. The captain was drunk in his cabin. The first mate was in the head. The second mate was in the galley. That was pretty much it for the crew. The ship was almost completely automated. There wasn't much a person could do. However, if a person just happened to press the emergency cargo release switch on the bridge, the automatic systems would take care of releasing huge quantities of black sludge into the sea. Millions of tons of crude oil, with devastating effect on the birds, fish, vegetation, animals, and humans of the region. Of course, there were dozens of fail-safe interlocks and foolproof safety backups, but what the hell? There always were. Afterwards, there was a huge amount of argument as to exactly whose fault it was. In the end, it was left unresolved. The blame was apportioned equally. Neither the captain, the first mate, nor the second mate ever worked again. For some reason, nobody gave much of a thought to Seaman White, who was already halfway to Indonesia on a tramp steamer piled high with rusting metal barrels of a particularly toxic weed killer. And there was another. He was in the square in Kambolaland, and he was in the restaurants, and he was in the fish, and in the air, and in the barrels of weed killer. He was on the roads, and in houses, and in palaces, and in hovels. There was nowhere that he was a stranger. And there was no getting away from him. He was doing what he did best, and what he was doing was what he was. He was not waiting. He was working. Harriet Dowling returned home with her baby, which, on the advice of Sister Faith Prolix, who was more persuasive than Sister Mary, and with the telephonic agreement of her husband, she had named Warlock. The cultural attaché returned home a week later and pronounced the baby the spit of his side of the family. He also had his secretary advertise in the Lady for a nanny. Crowley had seen Mary Poppins on television one Christmas. Indeed, behind the scenes, Crowley had had a hand in most television, although it was on the invention of the game show that he truly prided himself. He toyed with the idea of a hurricane as an effective and incredibly stylish way of disposing of the queue of nannies that would certainly form, or possibly stack up in a holding pattern, outside the cultural attaché's Regent's Park residence. He contented himself with a wildcat tube strike, and when the day came, only one nanny turned up. She wore a knit tweed suit and discreet pearl earrings. Something about her might have said, nanny, but it said it in an undertone of the sort employed by British butlers in a certain type of American film. It also coughed discreetly and muttered that she could well be the sort of nanny who advertises unspecified but strangely explicit services in certain magazines. Her flat shoes crunched up the gravel drive, and a grey dog padded silently by her side, white flecks of saliva dripping from its jaw. Its eyes glinted scarlet, and it glanced from side to side, hungrily. She reached the heavy wooden door, smiled to herself a brief, satisfied flicker, and rang the bell. It donged gloomily. The door was opened by a butler, as they say, of the old school. Footnote. A night school just off the Tottenham Court Road, run by an elderly actor who had played butlers and gentlemen's gentlemen in films and television and on the stage since the 1920s.
"I am Nanny Ashtoreth," she told him. "And this," she continued, while the grey dog at her side eyed the butler carefully, working out, perhaps, where it would bury the bones, "is Rover."
She left the dog in the garden and passed her interview with flying colours, and Mrs. Dowling led the nanny to see her new charge. She smiled unpleasantly.
"What a delightful child," she said. "He'll be wanting a little tricycle soon."
By one of those coincidences, another new member of staff arrived the same afternoon. He was the gardener, and as it turned out, he was amazingly good at his job. No one quite worked out why this should be the case, since he never seemed to pick up a shovel, and made no effort to rid the garden of the sudden flocks of birds that filled it and settled all over him at every opportunity. He just sat in the shade, while around him the residence gardens bloomed and bloomed. Warlock used to come down to see him when he was old enough to toddle, and Nanny was doing whatever it was she did on her afternoons off.
"This here's Brother Slug," the gardener would tell him, "and this tiny little critter is Sister Potato Weevil. Remember, Warlock, as you walk your way through the highways and byways of life's rich and fulsome path, to have love and reverence for all living things."
"Nanny says that living things is fit only to be ground under my heels, Mr. Francis," said little Warlock, stroking Brother Slug and then wiping his hand conscientiously on his Kermit the Frog overall.
"You don't listen to that woman," Francis would say. "You listen to me."
At night, Nanny Ashtoreth sang nursery rhymes to Warlock.
"Oh, the grand old Duke of York, he had 10,000 men. He marched them up to the top of a hill and crushed all the nations of the world and brought them under the rule of Satan, our master."
And
"this little piggy went to Hades. This little piggy stayed home. This little piggy ate raw and steaming human flesh. This little piggy violated virgins. And this little piggy clambered over a heap of dead bodies to get to the top. Brother Francis the gardener says that I myselflessly practice virtue and love to all living things," said Warlock. "You don't listen to that man, darling," the nanny would whisper as she tucked him into his little bed. "You listen to me."
And so it went. The arrangement worked perfectly. A no-score win. Nanny Ashtoreth bought the child a little tricycle, but could never persuade him to ride it inside the house. And he was scared of Rover. In the background, Crowley and Aziraphale met on the tops of buses and in art galleries and at concerts, compared notes, and smiled.
When Warlock was six, his nanny left, taking Rover with her. The gardener handed in his resignation on the same day. Neither of them left with quite the same spring in their step with which they'd arrived. Warlock now found himself being educated by two tutors. Mr. Harrison taught him about Attila the Hun, Vlad Dracul, and the darkness intrinsicate in the human spirit. Footnote. He avoided mentioning that Attila was nice to his mother, or that Vlad Dracul was punctilious.